We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
In this part of Focus 580, we'll bring you a story that has to do with civil rights in this country and elsewhere. And it also has to do with Thurgood Marshall. Now, I'm sure that a lot of people will know about Thurgood Marshall for his involvement as a lawyer doing civil rights law and for the fact that he was the first African-American to sit on the U.S. Supreme Court. But there is a part of his life story that is perhaps not so well-known, and we'll be talking about here this morning, and that is his involvement in the racial politics of another country, and that country being Kenya. Back in 1960, he was asked to help the people who were preparing the country for independence, help to write a new constitution. And in fact, he drafted a preliminary Bill of Rights for the country. He visited Kenya a couple of times and formed a deep kind of bond and connection with the country. And that was something that he held on to the very end of his life. This morning, in this part of Focus 580, we'll talk a little bit about this story. And our guest for the program is Mary Dudziak. She is a professor of law, also history and political science at the University of Southern California Gould School of Law. And this is a story that she has written about in a book that was published back in 2008. The title of her book is Exporting American Dreams, Thurgood Marshall's African Journey. And it's published by the Oxford University Press, and I'm sure that you can find the book if that you would like to take a look at it. In her teaching and research, she's interested in a number of things, including the history of modern history of the U.S. Constitution and also civil rights history. And she's joining us this morning by telephone. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. If it would be a long-distance call, we have a toll-free line for that. That's 800-222-9455. Also, you can email your question to will-talk@illinois.edu. But whatever way you do it, please keep it brief. That way we can get in as many different people as possible. Professor Dudziak, hello.
Hello, good morning.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Well, I think I probably said this certainly more than once on this program, but one of the things that we really like to be able to do is to bring to people a story that will be new to them. And I'm sure that for a lot of people, this I'm not sure how much most people know about Thurgood Marshall, but for a lot of people who do know him in these other reference frames, you know, as civil rights attorney and as Supreme Court justice, this story is going to be new.
That's right. For many folks, when they think of Thurgood Marshall, they think of him towards the end of his life as an aging member of the United States Supreme Court. He was, of course, the first African-American Supreme Court justice. And for folks who know more civil rights history, they think of him as a lawyer in the context of the civil rights movement, especially the lead counsel for the NAACP Legal Defense Fund at the time that Brown versus Board of Education was argued in the Supreme Court. But biographers have pretty much passed over this really important moment in his life in the middle of his career when he was transitioning from civil rights lawyer to being a lower court judge, Second Circuit Court of Appeals in New York, then to being Solicitor General of the U.S., the lawyer who argues for the U.S. in the Supreme Court, and then finally in 1967 became a Supreme Court justice. This was an exciting time in American history, the time of the Kennedy years, Lyndon Johnson's presidency, the Vietnam War, and, of course, the civil rights movement really taking off in a new way with the student movement. So it was a very rich period in American history, and during this time, Thurgood Marshall has this important engagement with nationalists in Kenya as Kenya is moving towards independence. And as exciting as the 60s was in the United States, it was also a pivotal decade in Africa as many nations became independent for the first time.
Yeah. And I think it's just worth underscoring the point, as I know you have talked about here, and as you talked about the story elsewhere, really made the point that so many people have treated this time in his life as being kind of a side trip on the journey of his life. But for him, this was something that was one of his most cherished moments and experiences, and something that he was still talking about this at the end of his life.
Yes, he had an object from Kenya, a cape that was a ceremonial cape made of monkey skin. And his son told me that, in his later years, when people would come over to the house, it was the one thing that he would pull out and show off to people, and he would put it on, and he would just light up. And this was a time when, Thurgood Marshall was not a very happy man. The court had moved away from his vision of justice, and he was becoming infirm and having a harder time in his life. And so these memories of Kenya, which were evoked by this cape, was the one thing his son said that would make him just light up. And it was so sort of central to his sort of sense of self-identity that one sort of vignette that was so interesting to me is a photographer went into his office after Thurgood Marshall passed away in 1993. And sure enough, there in the office, draped over a chair by the window, was this cape from Kenya. And so he kept it close to him to the very end.
There are two other, I think, big themes that you deal with here, and I think are worth maybe talking a little bit right here at the beginning. One of them is the connections that African-Americans, particularly at this time, and particularly African-Americans who were involved in civil rights here in the United States, the connections they felt to Africa and what that meant to them.
Yes, this is a topic that many scholars have written about, especially recently Jim Campbell's book Middle Passages, which covers the broad swath of African-American engagement in Africa, and Sita Hartman's more recent book that's more biographical. For Marshall, Africa was sort of a curiosity in this sort of distant land calling to him, but he had never been to Africa before 1960, and he viewed it as, he started calling it his homeland. And one of the most interesting documents I found as I was researching this was in the papers of the African nationalist that whose ties with Marshall got him to Africa in the first place, Tom Mboya. And Mboya basically wrote him sort of a thank you note after Marshall had been to Kenya to help them out in 1960. And he said to Marshall that upon Marshall's arrival, as you yourself said, you were glad to be home, and we were glad to welcome you home. And so he had this sort of connection with it as this sort of imaginary homeland. And so that was part of the important emotional tie, I think, between Marshall and Kenya. His family, as far as he knew, had not come from that part of the continent. And so Kenya was, in some ways, a stand-in for Africa as homeland for Thurgood Marshall.
Mm-hmm. The other thing here that I think is very interesting has to do with the impact of the Supreme Court decision in Brown v. Board of Education, and something certainly here in the United States we talk a lot about. We were particularly back a few years back when we came to the anniversary of the big anniversary, where we talked a lot about its impact and people asked what sort of impact it had. So we talk a lot about what that's meant for the United States and for children here in this country. But I think one of the things that you really try to point out in the book is that Brown v. Board had was a global event. It had international impact. And that is something I think that we don't really think very much about.
Absolutely. It's very important that to think about American domestic developments and how they resonate around the world. And Brown was one such event, and I actually talk about this in greater detail in my first book, Cold War Civil Rights. But the important dynamic sort of setting this up was that race in America was a global story. The U.S. in the years after World War II was becoming the leader of the, what was thought of as the free world. And in the context of the deepening Cold War, other countries came to question American leadership because of American racial practices. And it, people in other countries would say, you know, how is it that American democracy is supposed to be the model for other countries when within the leading democracy of the world, African Americans are disenfranchised, African American children are sent to segregated schools, people are lynched, and lynchers go unpunished. So they took American racial practices as an indication about what American democracy was like. American diplomats and presidents from Truman through Johnson came to understand that racial problems were having a devastating effect on the U.S. image around the world and on American foreign relations. So when Brown came along, and by the way, the State Department provided data about the impact of racism on the U.S. image around the world to the Justice Department that was put in the briefs that were filed in Brown. Then when Brown itself is decided, it was this international symbol that yes, American democracy is behind the concept of racial equality, and it helped to turn around this negative view around the world about American racial practices.
Mm-hmm. So as far as the U.S. government was concerned, or maybe U.S. State Department, the involvement of someone like Thurgood Marshall in this Kenyan independence project, as far as they were concerned, that would be a good thing for the United States.
Well, when he first got involved, their reaction was sort of yes and no. On the one hand, Marshall was, whether he wanted to be or not, he was a walking symbol of the vision that the U.S. government had tried to portray in American propaganda or information materials disseminated around the world, that within American democracy, African Americans could achieve great things and great prominence. And so from that, the argument was made for many years, there's nothing wrong with American racial practices. American democracy is a good thing because, look, we have African Americans like Thurgood Marshall who are able to succeed. And so he helped to fulfill this vision that the U.S. had been trying to convey to overturn the negative sense of American racial practices around the world. At the same time, both the U.S. government and the British, when it first started to get around that Thurgood Marshall was going to be going to this big conference in London on the Kenya Constitution in 1960, the Americans and the British thought, what's going on here, and why is he doing this? And a British citizen wrote into the British government and said, do you know that this man is part of the NAACP, which he said wrongly, is a communist organization? What's he going to be doing at our constitutional conference here in London? So Marshall was seen by them as an outsider and someone who, you know, they thought was potentially a troublemaker. But then the interesting thing was that he ended up playing a role that around the table was seen to be helpful. It was really kind of an extraordinary thing. There were no other private citizens at this big constitutional conference, which was between the British government and different political interests in what was then the colony of Kenya. And so here's this American, private citizen, not a government representative of anybody, serving as an advisor to one of the principal Kenya groups at these negotiations. And it was really quite an extraordinary moment. Then what happens along the way is both the British and the Americans come around, and because they thought that Marshall's role was so helpful, they ended up saying in their internal memorandum, you know, essentially, thank God Marshall was here. You know, what would we have done without him?
Mm-hmm. And that's it's really interesting here, and perhaps a bit ironic, maybe, given Marshall's involvement in civil rights here in the United States, is that he was very concerned with minority rights in Kenya. And this particular case, the rights that concerned him, and I'm sure also concerned the British government, were in this case the white minority in Kenya. And Marshall was very concerned with how it is that minorities, white people and also Indians, people from Pakistan and people from West Asia or from South Asia who were living there were being treated.
Absolutely. There are sort of two things to think about here, and this is what's complicated about this kind of a narrative. There's the U.S. side and there's the Kenya side, and then the way that they get intersected. In the Kenya context, moving into these negotiations in 1960, the colony had been through a period of a very destructive political violence. There had been an independence movement and then a British brutal counterinsurgency campaign. And this period in the 1950s is called the Mau Mau Rebellion. And so the colony was just starting to come out of a state of emergency and terrible political repression at the time that the groups are coming to the table. Meanwhile, independence is basically on the rise across Africa. Through 1960, violence would break out in the Congo, in South Africa. And so the question of really whether social change would happen in any kind of a stable way was unclear and unknown at that time. Whites were issuing terrorist threats in Kenya. But the British government came to support the position that Kenya should move towards essentially majority rule, one person, one vote. And so the folks who were thought of as the moderate whites in Kenya basically had the position that they would only stay at the table and continue to negotiate if there was going to be essentially an American-style set of provisions in the Constitution that protected, that included a Bill of Rights and judicial review, courts enforcing rights, as opposed to the political branches ensuring rights. And so that was a major issue at this constitutional conference. The issue of minority rights was seen by everyone around the table, including the African nationalists that Marshall worked with, that was a necessary part of that stage in the negotiations. As far as Marshall was concerned, he would often say that what he was interested in was, sometimes he would call it human rights, and the point was really that he was interested in equality across the board, equality for all individuals. And so in many ways, it wasn't difficult for him to think about minority rights in a very different context than the one he had experienced. And the basic sort of structural sort of idea is that you can't count on a majority government of any kind to protect the interests of discrete groups that don't have majority voting power. In Kenya, it was the groups who had been in power and were now going to be out of power. In the U.S., it was a very different context, and, of course, he knew it was a different context, where you had African-Americans and other people of color who had long been disenfranchised and left out. And so minority rights in the U.S. context was a way of protecting these interests on the part of groups who'd never had political power.
Let me introduce again our guest for this hour of Focus 580. We're talking with Mary Dodziak. She is a professor of law, history, and political science at the University of Southern California Gould School of Law. She teaches 20th century U.S. constitutional history and also civil rights history. She is the author of the book Exporting American Dreams, Thurgood Marshall's African Journey. It was published in 2008 by the Oxford University Press, and it talks about, among the things, talks about Thurgood Marshall's work with the leaders in Kenya as they were trying to put together a new nation after independence, and his role in drafting a preliminary Bill of Rights for a Kenyan constitution. Questions are welcome, 333-9455. That's for Champaign Urbana. Toll free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. How I don't know how many people the Kenyans might have thought about asking to do what they asked Marshall to do. How was it that it was him that was the one who got the invitation?
Well, there were connections between a roundabout set of connections that essentially were between the U.S. labor movement and civil rights movement. And the key person from Kenya was Tom Mboya, who was a charismatic young political figure in Kenya who came to prominence through the labor movement. In the colony of Kenya at the time, there was a ban on cross-colony political organizing, but there wasn't a ban on labor organizing. Mboya was able to work through and move to sort of both colony-wide and then ultimately international prominence through his work as a labor organizer. And he came to the attention of folks in the British Labour Party who supported his time in England, where he was able to broaden out his understanding of politics at University of Oxford, and then ultimately through international labor organizations got to know folks in the U.S., including the UAW. United Auto Workers Union. And he also got to know A. Philip Randolph, who was a pivotal African-American labor and civil rights leader who became something of a mentor to Mboya. So it was through these ties that Mboya ends up in a couple of whirlwind tours in the U.S. In the late 1950s. And in 1960 was really sort of a darling of progressives in the United States. Mboya ended up getting a lot of support from the U.S., including important financial support. This was a time when the American government was starting to wake up to the importance of developing ties with African leaders, because the continent was moving towards independence. And if the United States wasn't involved with new political leaders, then the U.S. was going to have difficulty developing strong international ties, basically in the context of the Cold War, leaving the field open to the Soviet Union. So it was through this sort of set of ties with the labor movement that that Marshall ends up linking up with Mboya in the late 1950s. New progressive groups interested in U.S. involvement in Africa basically put two and two together floated the idea to Mboya and the Africans that Thurgood Marshall would be a good advisor. But one of the interesting things is they were basically looking outside of both Africa and Britain for an advisor. They felt that they needed a different model. And so they also, before they got in touch with Marshall, were floating, you know, connections with other U.S. constitutional scholars. For example, Thomas Emerson at Yale Law School, who was interested but not able to participate. In many ways, he wouldn't have been the same kind of sort of symbolic presence as Marshall, this major figure in American minority rights. Mm. But that helps us to see that the Africans were looking outside of the models of British and African constitutional development, and that in of itself was sort of a big step, because the British themselves thought of the U.S. Constitution as kind of a ridiculous system that was too complicated and wasn't a good way to organize a new government.
Marshall certainly knew about American politics and American constitutional law, but when he went in 1960, when he went to Kenya, he didn't know anything about Kenyan politics and Kenyan law. Was that a problem?
Well, you know, he really knew very little. He'd had some connections with essentially refugees from Kenya in the 50s, but really knew very little. And as he was preparing to go, Jim Neighbourit, who was then a young lawyer in the Legal Defense Fund office, essentially hands him some materials, which included the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. So Marshall basically pulls together a lot of material, but international ideas about constitutionalism, you know, simply weren't part of his day-to-day work as a civil rights lawyer. What then happens for Marshall is he encounters colonialism when he gets to Kenya. He is supposed to be meeting with these groups of nationalists who are preparing for this big constitutional conference in London, and he's barred from attending a meeting. And the way Marshall tells the story in his oral history, he goes to the meeting, and there are all these Africans sort of out in a field. The leaders were going into the meeting, but they were barred from going in. And then the colonial officer basically says to Marshall, you know, you can't go in. You don't have a permit. And Tom Boya says, well, we got a permit. And the officer says, yes, and it was revoked yesterday. And then Marshall tells a story. And this is partly, you know, there's sort of other evidence that this is what happened, but it's also sort of Marshall as a storyteller. So Marshall says, he says to the colonial officer, well, okay, but would you mind if I just had said a word to all of these people out there who he, you know, assumed knew, you know, that he had come to work with them? And the colonial officer says, no speeches. And Marshall says, well, I just want to say one word. And the officer says, okay, well, one word. And so Marshall then, who's a big man, sort of jumps up on top of the station wagon that they had been driving, and then shouts to the crowd the word Uhuru. And Uhuru meant, you know, independence now. And so it was the slogan of the independence movement, and the crowd just sort of erupts, which, of course, got Marshall in trouble. But the process of going to Kenya and then going to London was a process of learning both about different forms of oppression than he had experienced in the United States, but also learning about constitutionalism and human rights law around the world. And then one of the most interesting things is, you know, apparently he said to Juan Williams, who interviewed him for his biography of Thurgood Marshall, American Revolutionary, Marshall apparently said to Juan Williams that before he went to Kenya, he looked around at all these different constitutions of the world, and the American one was the best one he'd seen, slamming his fist on the table. And that's what he took to Kenya. Well, on some level, of course, he took the U.S. Constitution to Kenya. That was part of his mindset and part of the way he understood what constitutional law was. But what he then writes into his Bill of Rights for Kenya, there's a sort of an American sensibility there, a Marshall American sensibility, not a sensibility of what the American Constitution was at the time or really would become. And so he opens it with a preamble that's all about equality, equality then being the basis within which all the other rights in the Bill of Rights would be framed. But then the precise language that he incorporates isn't American language. It comes especially from the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and it also came from two other recently independent, new post-colonial constitutions of Nigeria and Malaya. So, you know, one of the most interesting things is, you know, he draws all this material from the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And the main difference there between the U.S. Constitution and the Bill of Rights that Marshall wrote was that his Bill of Rights included positive social rights, social and economic rights, a right to essentially not be poor, what we would now call a right to a living wage, as well as positive rights to education, as opposed to the U.S. Constitution, where you have a right essentially not to be discriminated against in access to government services, but you don't have a fundamental right to those services. So he not only learned about these things, but they resonated enough with what he thought was important that he wrote them into his Bill of Rights.
Just a bit past our midpoint here, I'd like to introduce again our guest, Mary Dudziak. She is a professor of law, history, and political science at the University of Southern California Gould School of Law. And we're talking about the involvement of Thurgood Marshall in the independence of Kenya. He was invited to go there when the country was preparing for independence to help with writing a constitution, which he did. And as we have explained, it was something that maybe it's a story that people don't really know, but it was an experience that he was very important to him and something that he talked about to the very end of his life. And this is a story that our guest tells in a book that she wrote, was published in 2008 by the Oxford University Press. Her book is Exporting American Dreams, Thurgood Marshall's African Journey. So I'm sure you can still find the book if you'd like to read it. Questions are welcome too. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. So if you're here locally, use that one. Toll free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Just going back to what it is that he wrote, this draft that he wrote to be the Bill of Rights for the Kenyan Constitution, did much of that actually survive and become part of the Kenyan Constitution?
Well, much of it was essentially lost on the cutting room floor. And one of the developments in the story really is Marshall could always be an idealist when it came to thinking about Kenya law and rights in Kenya. Marshall was this idea person coming from outside of what would become the country of Kenya, and not someone who would be directly engaged in governance. And so he could build in all of these strong positive social welfare rights. But then, essentially, those kinds of rights weren't in the interest of what would become the independent Kenya government. If you think about it, what became the country of Kenya had never been a country before. The boundaries of Kenya were set by colonial powers when they divided up Africa among themselves in the scramble for Africa in the 1880s. And so you have these different ethnic groups bound together into what becomes a country and having been sort of put together by decisions on the part of colonial powers, many, many years earlier. And so one of the challenges that these newly independent governments had was, pulling together these diverse groups, making a nation out of this diversity in a context where you have decades of terrible injustice and concerns on the part of many for redress and fairness and sometimes retribution. And so how do you build a country in this kind of a context? And so the effort was essentially to consolidate power. And that's what Jomo Kenyatta, who became the first president of Kenya, ultimately did. So Kenyatta turns to consolidating power and ultimately to using the Constitution as a tool of his power, as opposed to what would have been Marshall's vision, having a Constitution as a restraint on the power of the executive. So that was really a sort of a fundamental tension that was bound to arise, but something that Marshall didn't really seem to be on Marshall's radar screen as he was working with these folks as they were independence leaders, sort of moving for independence in the years before they they became the new government of Kenya.
Well, that was something here. There's an interesting sort of tension that seems to be between the kind of society and the kind of order that I think Marshall would have liked to see, on the one hand, and on the other hand, his admiration for the country's leaders, particularly Jomo Kenyatta, on the other. How did he reconcile those two things?
You know, that's one of the really interesting problems in writing this book is how to make sense of what seems like a contradiction, essentially. And this comes out in Marshall's second trip to Kenya in 1963. Well, his second and his third trip. He goes back twice in 1963. At this point, he's no longer a civil rights lawyer. He's a federal judge on the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. And this time it's the State Department that asks Marshall to go to Kenya. And it's in the wake of terrible violence against civil rights demonstrators in the United States. So again, these sort of connections between events in the U.S. and international affairs, when peaceful civil rights demonstrators in the U.S. in Birmingham, Alabama, were just brutalized by Bull Connor, the police commissioner, and his police dogs and fire hoses, pummeling demonstrators. Pictures of this were disseminated around the world, and generated global criticism. And so the State Department sends speakers around the world, including judges, not just Thurgood Marshall, but also Chief Justice Earl Warren went to Africa to basically try to reassure the world that there was law and order in the U.S. And that American democracy was on the side of equality, not on the side of this kind of brutal violence. So it's that context that gets Marshall to Kenya again in 1963. And then right away, he discovers that things aren't working the way he would have liked. And his trembling companion, a young white lawyer at the time, Burl Bernhardt, who was then head of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission, goes along with him. And he told me the story about how they're kind of driving through Nairobi on the first day, and they see signs that make it look as if Asians in Kenya, who were a major minority group, in terms of size of groups, the white community, white settlers were a smaller group, and then I don't remember the numbers, but then a larger ethnic group of Asians who had largely been laborers and sort of a middle class, business class in Kenya, and then the vastly overwhelming number of indigenous Africans. So they stopped at a shop where a shop owner had a sign in the window that said forced to leave, and they went in to see what was going on, and the shop owner said that that they were being boycotted, they couldn't get any business, and it looked as if Asians were being discriminated against, and Marshall was completely irate because he felt that he'd built in minority rights protections into the Bill of Rights. And now his friends, you know, the people who he thought saw as his allies, were moving into positions of power during this period of self-rule before Kenya became independent later in 63. And why was it that this discrimination was happening when his friends were now in power? And so at the end of the day, they go to a cocktail party. And this is, of course, a fancy cocktail party with government officials, and Marshall essentially misbehaves, and he goes up to Jomo Kenyatta, who again is now the prime minister, would be president of Kenya at independence. He sort of officially takes on that mantle in December 63, and Marshall says, "Jomo, what the hell are you doing?" And Burl Bernhardt, his traveling companion, thinks, "Oh my God!" And Marshall just says, "You know, you promised me, you know, you promised that you were gonna we have this constitution with a Bill of Rights, and you know, you all promised me that you were going to protect minority rights. And look what's happening. Asians are being discriminated against. They can't stay in the country and operate their businesses. What are you going to do about it?" And so then there's this effort to sort of placate Marshall, and you know, really we plan to look at these things, and so there's this sort of tension that arises as Marshall is very aware that that things don't look good in terms of rights being protected, but then the interesting potential conflict there is. You know, he goes back the next December. He's one of the only private citizens who is a full-paid guest of the new Kenya government at their independence ceremonies in December. And he's so proud to stand up with them and celebrate this transition of power. And so really a question is, how could he be so really full of pride and happiness? That power is now vested in the hands of his friends, who he also knew had not been protecting individual rights. And the way Burl Bernhardt describes their conversations about it is, you know, he says that Marshall saw more goodness in Jomo Kenyatta than Bernhardt ever thought was warranted, and so he would push him on it. And Marshall said, if it hadn't been for him, there would have been a bloodbath like you'd never seen. That Kenyatta was the one person who could have really helped this colony move to independence without everything falling apart. And essentially, the British and the Americans in their intelligence documents were essentially saying the same thing about Kenyatta's role as a father figure, essentially, of the movement, able to bring people together across divisions, enabling Kenya to move to independence in a way that was relatively peaceful when violence was breaking out so many other places. And, you know, it really seemed to be that the bottom line for him was independence, you know, essentially freedom. In the U.S. context, it was moving out of enslavement. You know, that it was that kind of symbolic move from colonialism to independence, slavery to freedom, that was really the core value, and that even though equality was a central feature for Marshall, just part of his core beliefs, when it came down to it, he was proud to have been a part of that movement to freedom, and was able to not really look past, but to continue to love these individuals and admire them in spite of his simultaneous disappointment with them.
Yeah. We have about 5 minutes left. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Mary Dudziak. She is a professor of law, history, political science at the University of Southern California Gould School of Law. We have a caller here, and we'll go right there, Champaign County, line one. Hello.
Hi. Raising so much, it's a very provocative story. You mentioned the colonial legacy, and I think as well as a very brutal Mau Mau uprising and reaction by the British that's been chronicled. I think Focus has had the author on that story. But what the Indians were there as part of the British colonization too. So it's a legacy of playing off the players. They were used in many places in the empire. That's not an excuse for the violence against them, et cetera, but I think it's a deeper analysis that this is also a colonial legacy. But what promoted me to call is that there's more than a little irony in your title, I think, because Exporting the American Way, the economic rights that you referred to that he wrote into the Constitution that were then sort of finessed by the Kenyans have never been U.S. policy. The U.S. to this day has not signed what was promulgated in the UN human rights resolutions, and we always have had a provision that we don't accept that kind of thing. And the Kenyan government would have had a willing accomplice or partner in not respecting that. Anything along those lines, because the U.S. still to this day hasn't taken that. That's a lot, and I guess I'll just hang up and listen since there's a few minutes left here. Thank you.
All right.
Well, perhaps I can just say briefly, I appreciate the caller's points, and I would encourage readers interested in the broader political history of Kenya. Carolyn Elkins and David Anderson both had prize-winning, fabulous books within the past few years on the Mau Mau period. The reason the book is titled Exporting American Dreams is because that's essentially what Marshall took with him. The caller is absolutely right. The ideas that Marshall built into his Bill of Rights were never signed on to by the United States government, these positive social welfare rights. You do see elements of them, however, in Marshall's own jurisprudence, his concerns about the poor, and his understanding that poverty and disenfranchisement and the creation of an underclass is tremendously troublesome in a country that is committed to principles of equality. And so essentially what I suggest with the title is that Marshall didn't take American law, in essence, to Kenya. He took his dreams for American equality to Kenya, his dreams and aspirations of what he hoped for, but would never be accomplished in his own country. I mean, that's one of the tragedies of the book.
We're coming to the point here. We have a couple of minutes left. One of the things that I wanted to ask you was whether you feel that his experience in Kenya and his involvement in the early days of independence in that country, that's some of what he learned or saw or what he was involved with, he then, in a sense, brought back or shaped his attitudes towards the continuing civil rights struggle here in the United States. Here we're talking about the early 60s. He didn't join the court until 1967. Is there some way, do you think, that this experience shaped his thinking about civil rights in the United States?
Well, you know, I wish I could say yes, and let me give you five examples. But really what I have to say is I looked and looked and looked, and what I found is his continuing interest in Africa, his continuing involvement when he had time greeting visitors from Africa, talking about Africa at speaking events. So he continued to be interested and engaged on that level, but he was really quite consumed with his role in the United States as a judge. Once he becomes Solicitor General, he's part of the Johnson administration, and then he becomes a member of the United States Supreme Court, and really found, I think, those roles to be all-consuming. And so what happens, you know, with his Kenya experience is it becomes for him this important memory at a time when his vision for what he'd like to accomplish on the Supreme Court itself is falling apart. The court essentially is turning away from his vision. He's not seeing effective enforcement of the civil rights norms that he had tried to fight for his whole life. And so Kenya is this this idea and this cherished memory that in some ways he holds in a way that is disconnected from the reality of what Kenya would become. So that even when he goes back in 78 for Kenyatta's funeral, he is simply unwilling or unable to see the fact that that Kenya had become a repressive society, and individual rights were not being protected, and that I think reinforces the way that it sort of comes for him this memory that enables him to, you know, wake up in the morning and go on, that in spite of everything that's happening around him in his own nation, that he had been there with the founders of a new nation and had helped with this moment when they moved over the threshold towards independence.
Just one other thing here, and we have like about a minute and a half or 2 minutes, just something a little bit different, but I'm interested in you're talking about how it's connected, his feelings for another larger-than-life figure, something you talk about here at the very end of the book, and the guy I'm talking about here is Lyndon Johnson, that apparently Marshall actually had some significant admiration for LBJ and was tried at least to support Johnson at the end of the his presidency, which was, of course, a very difficult time for him.
Marshall loved LBJ. That's how it's been described to me by his family and his friends. He had deep admiration for LBJ because he saw him as someone who was uniquely able to, in a position, because of President Johnson's great political power and abilities in the Senate. To get civil rights legislation through, and President Johnson, of course, taking on the mantle of Camelot, essentially after the President Kennedy's assassination, basically called the Civil Rights Bill, part of Kennedy's memory, and used that memory of John Kennedy to get the first significant civil rights legislation in decades through Congress, and so he saw LBJ as this pivotal figure in American civil rights history, and someone who was deeply committed to civil rights and not someone who simply saw it as a matter of politics. So he loved LBJ, and he was loyal to him, towards the end. And I think that admiration cut both ways. In the terrible days after Martin Luther King's assassination in 1968, when many wondered whether the country was simply going to fall apart. There was a meeting of civil rights leaders with the president. President Johnson called together civil rights leaders from around the country, and at this meeting, there was Thurgood Marshall, now a Supreme Court justice, sitting right next to the president, trying to figure out how the nation should move forward. In the final days of the LBJ administration, when Johnson is now essentially a failed president, having decided because of the opposition to his Vietnam policies and the anti-war movement, he's not going to get reelected, and he doesn't. He announces that he will not run. And Marshall sends a message to the White House. He wants to have a meeting with the president, and the president says, "Well, find out what he wants to meet about." And the message comes back, "Well, he wants to have meet with LBJ, with a group of, as Marshall called it then, Negro leaders, to basically thank the president for all that he had done for them." And so he was just a staunch supporter of LBJ to the end. And in some ways, I think that admiration for a pivotal figure helps us to understand his love and admiration for someone like Jomo Kenyatta, who he also just saw as someone who was uniquely situated, able to play a role in history that no one else could have played. In our own day, we might think of, a sort of pivotal historical figure like Nelson Mandela. Obviously very different than either of these individuals, but an example of someone in history who both has the personal skills and vision and charisma, and is at the right place at the right time, able to do things that it's hard to imagine anyone else having done.
We're going to have to stop there. The book is Exporting American Dreams, Thurgood Marshall's African Journey, published by Oxford University Press, came out in the summer of 2008 by our guest Mary Dudziak. She's a professor of law, history, political science at University of Southern California Gould School of Law. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.